You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 6th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, my friends. How are you?
Good. How are you, Evan?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Jay is conspicuously absent this week. Jay and his wife, just a couple of days ago, had their first child.
Yay. Slacker.
Yay, baby.
Gonna let a baby get in the way of SGU? Come on.
Yeah.
He's got to get his priorities straight.
Yeah.
So Jay is busy not sleeping and taking care of his wife and
cleaning
newborn.
Poop.
He had to know that was coming.
He's been practicing for that for years.
I wonder if the baby will have Jay's unique abilities to pee long distances.
Reference from two Dragon Cons ago.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
Hey, so happy Space Medicine Day.
Space Medicine.
It's not really a day, but it should be. It could be. I don't know. I just like the phrase space medicine, because if you put space in front of just about anything, it becomes more exciting.
Yeah, space monkey.
Yeah, way better.
Exciting. I like that.
We should talk about that, by the way. That space monkey that Iran apparently didn't send up. I don't know. That's a whole other thing. But that's not what I'm talking about.
There were pictures. That thing was so cute in a little suit. Little, you know.
Strapped down like it was. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but he didn't take any Instagrams from space. So, I don't know. Okay, but no, today, this day in history, 1949... February 9th, 1949, the first Department of Space Medicine was established at a U.S. Air Force Academy, the School of Aviation at Randolph Field, Texas. You might be able to guess what space medicine is all about. It's making sure astronauts don't die when they go into space, and all of the many things that entails. The guy who was the first professor of space medicine was Hubertus Strughold. And
what?
At this point, it becomes less fun because he was a horrific Nazi who did horrible, horrible, horrible things.
He a literal Nazi?
He was literally a Nazi. There were documents uncovered during the Nuremberg trials that linked him to really horrific medical experiments on concentration camp inmates.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, really horrific. U.S. space history is unfortunately littered with Nazis because that was one of the plunders that the U.S. got after the war was the brains behind a lot of Germany's advancements. And so one of those was Hubertus Strughold.
Well, that's that famous line from The Right Stuff. You know, our Nazis are better than their Nazis. Talking about the U.S. space program beating out the Soviet space program at the time.
Right. So yeah, there used to be an aeromedical library at Brooks Air Force Base named after him, but in 1977, when those documents were uncovered, it was renamed.
I bet you the whole field of space medicine really took off after people started going to space.
You think?
Prior to that, not that there was nothing they could do, but I mean, prior to that, I bet you it was mostly theoretical work.
Kind of like xenobiology.
A lot of dunking people in tanks of water. Things like that. I don't know.
I actually have a colleague who, while they were at Yale, they're not there anymore, but they were working on space medicine. They were had a grant from NASA, and they were suspending rats to see how their anti-gravity walking system would develop if they were raised essentially suspended to simulate zero gravity. The thinking being that if you like had a baby born in space and they grew up in zero gravity, they would never develop certain parts of their nervous system that are adapted to gravity.
Right.
Space baby.
And they would duplicate that by hanging them?
Suspending them from
their
rear legs, yeah.
Funny they never got to the human trials for that. Yeah.
Didn't NASA have those anti-gravity rooms like they showed in I Dream of Jeannie? You don't remember that?
No.
Anti-gravity rooms.
I remember I Dream of Jeannie.
I remember they, in a few episodes, they showed a room where you walked in, they hit a switch, and the gravity was turned off. And even
as a kid,
I was like, that's baloney. What are you doing?
I think that was Barbara Eden just blinking her eyes.
She didn't have to blink her eyes. That was Bewitched.
She did a nod and a blink.
No, Bewitched was the twitchy nose.
Oh, yeah, right.
Genie was the blinking of the
her
eyes.
Arms.
Do you remember when Genie had the drops put in her eyes and she couldn't blink and her magic was on the fritz? Come on.
No, I don't remember that. Why?
It's all about the blinking eyes.
What is with you guys and your encyclopedic knowledge of I Dream of Genie?
Of attractive magical women?
Yeah. I just remembered what Barbara Eden looked like, so never mind.
Major Nelson. Right. Major did not Nelson. Avail there. Himself of her talents.
Well, Evan, I understand there's a lake monster in Russia.
Where did you read that, Steve?
The Siberian Times.
It's true. It's true. Yeah, the world is, Steve and everyone, the world is full of lake monsters. And it seems that wherever human beings encounter very large lakes, there's bound to be a reported monster that lives in the lake. For example, we have Nessie, the monster from Loch Ness in Scotland. We have Champ in Lake Champlain in New York. Wally from Wallowa Lake in Oregon, and Woodsy from Lake of the Woods in Ontario, Canada, right?
Those are imaginative names.
Yes. but
the better to pull in the tourists, my friend. So, my dear.
Yes, exactly. And that leads us into this week's news item about the supposed lake monster of Lake Lubwinkir in Siberia. And our friends over at, I learned about this from livescience.com, a really good website. And they informed us this week that a team of scientists from the Russian Geographical Society have reported they found the skeletal remains of an animal that fits the description of the devil of Lake Lubwinkir. Now, you see, you got to leave it up to a bunch of people in the middle of nowhere to come up with some semblance of an original name for the creature, right? I mean, I was waiting to see if anyone was going to call it maybe labia or knicker or something.
Oh,
but thankfully they did. Well, you know, for Lake Lubwinkir, right? That's about all I could think of. But thankfully they did not do that. Thankfully they did not do that.
Oh boy.
They came up with devil. Now, reports of a lake monster here have began in the 19th century. The stories have not only prevailed for over 100 years, but they've gained traction, to the point where scientists seem to be actively looking for something resembling a monster in the lake. And with the discovery of these remains, they think they might have finally some concrete evidence that something unusual is or was down there. Some accounts of this monster in the lake have put the creature as big as 33 feet in length. That's pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
The lake is considered one of the more mysterious lakes in the world because of its temperatures. The temperatures in the area can reach as cold as minus 60 degrees Celsius, yet the waters in this lake do not completely freeze. They stay at a relatively balmy 2 degrees Celsius, or 36 degrees Fahrenheit. And the folks at the Siberian Times proudly wrote in a recent article that, I quote, "Scientists struggle to explain this phenomenon."
Are they baffled?
but they're just struggling, apparently. And for the first time, though, divers have reached the bottom of the lake during these very, very cold winter months. So this was some kind of record in that regard. And the dive was made at the request of Yakutia State University in order to take some footage. They actually brought cameras down to the bottom of the lake, and they also gathered samples of some of the water, flora, and fauna. Yet they also apparently found these skeletal remains, right?
Oh, good. So we have some hard evidence to examine.
Well, no, unfortunately.
But they found skeletons.
They did. They saw the skeletons. Unfortunately, for some reason, they didn't actually bring the bones up from
the lake. Okay, but they have pictures.
Well, sure. Of course they have. Well, not really. I mean,
well, obviously the bones were cursed. They couldn't move them and risk angering Satan, and they probably don't show up on film. So,
okay.
I'm convinced.
What we have are more stories about evidence. Now, let's see. Where have we heard about this before?
Yes.
Gee, in just about every other paranormal and pseudoscientific encounter
reports
we talk
of evidence,
about on the show.
But never the evidence itself.
Never the evidence itself. Hmm. Yep. And, on the other side of the coin, there are some scientists in Russia that are standing up for reason and skepticism, such as Yuri Gerasimov of the Institute of Freshwater Biology at the Russian Academy of Sciences. And he said, if we trust the stories about this devil, there must be about 1.5 meters or 5 feet between its eyes. This means the length of the body must be about 8 meters or up to 26 feet. And pike, it's rumored that, you know, it's a large pike that grew and grew and grew. But pike don't live so long in order to reach such a big size. In general, there are two factors that help fish to grow: nutrition and comfortable water temperature. So that even if the nutrition were perfect there, surely the temperatures were not high enough. So in his opinion, the view about a huge pike is a fantastic one.
Yeah, so it's an ichthyosaur.
Yes.
Oh, obviously.
Or a plesiosaur.
Yeah, whatever pleases you.
Or it's a labiosaur. We'll name it after.
Oh. That.
Plus, you got to think about the plausibility. I mean, how could a creature that large, first of all, evade scientific detection, and B, actually thrive in an environment like that? What would its food source be, right? Wouldn't it, like, gobble up most of its limited resources that would be under there? And what about the population? You know, there had to be some sort of sufficient breeding population in order for this thing to even be around in the first place. Where are the evidence of more of these creatures?
Well, Evan, what about the coelacanth? They dug that up after thinking it was extinct for millions of years. And how do you know there isn't some underground connection that connects to a larger body of water, or maybe even the ocean, that's bringing in an endless supply of food?
Those are interesting points, Steve. And, you know, I think perhaps some people tie the fact that because this lake does not totally freeze in the very frigid, frigid winter months, is that, you know, scientists are not really baffled so much by this. They do have plausible theories because it's a region of a lot of seismic activity. Fissures can open up and stuff, you know, leading to warm conditions coming up through the bottom of the lake that, you know, ultimately heat the lake. So there's perhaps some volcanic activity going on in the region. And yes, Steve, I guess it could open up to, you know, one of these areas could wind up opening up underground to some other regions.
Essentially, I mean, I'm throwing those out there because that's what they're saying, the believers, but that they're just making that up. I mean, they don't have any evidence that there's actually some kind of hidden underground connection to another lake. And even that, I mean, how big could it be, especially if we haven't found it?
It's all speculation. There is no solid evidence. And once again, the legend of this lake monster, continues and will continue.
But like all of them, I mean, the issue can be easily resolved by just finding some hard evidence, skeleton, for example. But, you know, it'll never be resolved the other way. Just there'll be how much time has to go by, like with Loch Ness, without finding evidence of the actual creature itself, before the mystery mongers will give up. You know, never it seems, right?
Or people who, you know, admit to having floated the balsam wood out there and taken the photograph of it, you know, admitted hoaxers. It doesn't matter. That doesn't dissuade the true believers either.
Yeah. Even if 95% are hoaxes, there's still that 5% that we can't explain.
No monsters, no remains of monsters, you know, no monster poop. No, you know, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like finding the bones of a long-dead British king under a parking lot or something like that.
Oh, boy. Nice segue. This news item was downright ubiquitous this week. It was crazy. Everywhere I turned, there it was. We're getting emails. Every website I went to, everyone's talking about this. And all because a skeleton was found under a parking lot or a car park. And, of course, there's a little bit more to it than that. It's a very special skeleton. In fact, it's been confirmed to belong to England's last Plantagenet king, King Richard III, the final monarch to die on a battlefield and the death that saw the start of the Tudor dynasty that lasted over a century. Now, Plantagenet...
It's pronounced Plantagenet.
It's a family name of the line of kings from Henry II to Richard III. That was from 1154 to 1485 AD, so very long. So clearly this seems to be a significant bag of bones, if it is King Richard, of course. But my first thought upon hearing this was, you know, how can they be so sure that it really, really is him and not just somebody that, you know, was from that time period or maybe was just related? So I think the best place to start is with his death. What do we know about how King Richard III died?
He needed a horse. I remember that.
He died a moita.
He died in the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485 and was said to be buried in Grey Friars Church, the location of which has been lost to history, of course, until now. He was defeated by the Tudor forces, which were half the size of his royal army, which I didn't know. I think they all had phaser rifles or something. That much, minus the lasers, of course, is generally accepted. So does his skeleton support that bit of history? Yes, it does. The skeleton shows 10 injuries, 8 of them to the skull alone, and they all occurred at the time of death. The worst injury was this nasty slice taken off like the back of his head. the back of his skull, probably made with a halberd, they think. And there was a smaller hole a little bit higher up.
Ooh, critical hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I was going to say, two, it did 2d6 damage.
Actually, two critical hits. The smaller one went, they think, went fairly deep, and it's probably caused by a sword. One or both of those most likely caused his death, perhaps instantaneously if they went deep enough, especially that smaller one. There were also smaller wounds to the head, lots of other ones, plus there were humiliation injuries, like a pelvic wound that was probably caused by a weapon thrust through his butt.
Ooh.
Boy, were they mad at him. Clearly this guy, whoever it may be, died in battle, as Richard was supposed to have, and not from, say, a heart attack or slipping on a banana peel or tripping over a peasant or something. This guy was in battle and it was nasty. So what about the time period? 1485, is the skeleton that old? And again, the answer is yes. Radiocarbon dating places it between the last half of the 15th century and the early 16th century. So that's a perfect match for 1485. Then what about the age of the man's bones when he died? If they belong to a teenager or an old guy, game over. It can't be Richard. And again, Dr. Jo Appleby, she's an osteoarchaeologist, from the School of Archaeology and Ancient History. She says that the bones belong to a man in his late 20s or early 30s, which if you know a lot about bones, you can pretty much definitively say, just pretty much by looking at them, I think. Richard was 32 years old when he died, so there's another perfect match. And this was pretty interesting. Another piece of evidence derived from the carbon dating was the fact that this person had a high protein diet. And you might say, big deal, but that it includes a lot of fish, apparently, and that points to a very high status person. In that time, you did not eat a lot of fish if you were a peasant.
How do you know he's the king?
He ate fish. So another thing evident from the bones was a distinct curvature of the spine. This person clearly had scoliosis. And this again matches our modern conception of Richard III. You may remember Shakespeare's play. Richard III depicts him as a deformed hunchback. He describes him as rudely stamped and unfinished. In reality, the owner of these bones would not have been as bad as that. His height was probably affected, and one shoulder would have been higher than the other one. And even this makes sense, even though it's not a perfect match to how he's typically envisioned. It makes sense, though, because it makes sense that Shakespeare would exaggerate this. He lived during the Tudor reign, after all, and who would want to piss them off? So in a sense, his play could be seen as kind of like a propaganda of sorts.
Mocking Richard III a little bit.
For the ruling empire. I mean, that was a story that was being put out there, and he went with it, whether he believed it or not, you know, doesn't matter. And it just makes a lot of sense that it would be exaggerated, but it's just not as bad as he's often displayed. Finally, there's the king of evidence, DNA. At first, it seemed unlikely, actually, that DNA would be found, considering the age of the bones. Luckily, though, the conditions under the car park were very good for bone preservation, and they did get some from the teeth and his right femur. And this was really cool. A team of enthusiasts and historians did did incredibly difficult and detailed genealogical research, just trying to find out, you know, can we find somebody that is clearly part of this family line? And they actually did. They found a 17th generation descendant of Richard's sister, and they used her and her son. Which it's funny because this was like the last generation because there were no more women in the family. So that line is over now. It's not going to, you know, there's not going to be any more. So they got her DNA, and even though I think she had died relatively recently, they got some of her DNA and hit and the son, and they did a positive match. They were definitely related. But how cool would that be to find out that you're a relative of Richard III?
Cool.
I'm sure they didn't. So what?
There are better people that I'd rather.
Yeah, wasn't he considered a bit tyrannical?
You know, you got to place him in his time. You know, a lot of kings at that time killed a lot of people in order to get to the top. What we know about him does come from the people that won, you know, and they can pretty much say whatever they want. So I don't think he's.
Well, this descendant, Bob, you should make a bid to take back the throne for his family.
Absolutely.
I don't think it works that way.
You're out of here, Elizabeth.
It is a fascinating story because in my research, of course, I was doing some.
He just like arm wrestle with Prince Charles or something.
Yeah, right. It's a fascinating story. So, hey, definitely check this out on the web. There's so many angles. There's so many different ways and different aspects to this story. And not just the evidence I've discussed. I mean, I found that the most compelling and wanted to talk about that. But there's also, they did facial reconstruction and how that works to find out, you know, what he maybe looked like. There's also some big controversy going on now about who gets to determine where the skeleton is buried, etc. There's lots of different things to look at and learn about this. And if you learn a little bit about history, like I did, it'd be worth it. So check it out.
This reminded me, do you guys remember this? It's Hurricane Sandy back in October.
What is the connection?
I kind of remember.
Yeah, I think I do remember.
Upturned a tree in the New Haven Green, a really old oak tree. And a woman looking at the, you know, the roots underneath the tree saw a skeleton like embedded in the roots of the tree.
Cool.
So cool.
And it turned out to be like a 200-year-old skeleton. The story is that there was a graveyard on the green, and just like in the movie Poltergeist, they moved the headstones, but they left the bodies behind when they turned it into a green. So there's like hundreds of bodies under the green in the middle of New Haven.
How awesome is that?
Crazy. That was a spooky movie, too.
Yeah. And this one just happened to be underneath this famous old oak tree. Pretty cool.
Excellent. Near that.
Hey, Bob, I have a question.
Yeah.
Is now the winter of our discontent?
Oh, God.
What's the next line?
Made glorious summer by the sun of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried.
Very impressive.
Bosom. Bosom.
So many plays on word there. It's great.
So there's an interesting article in Nature, and which is then further discussed in Scientific American, which I came across, and it asks a question that has come up a little bit on the show before, and that is, are there scientific geniuses today, or will there be again like there was in the past? So will we have another Newton, Darwin, or Einstein? Or is the age of the scientific genius simply over? What are your guys' thoughts about that?
Yeah, Steve, this absolutely reminds me of Stephen Jay Gould's book, Full House. He discusses this idea in relation to the disappearance of 400 hitters in baseball. And it goes over lots of the theories. The bottom line was that everyone is just so close to the wall of maximal performance that it's very hard for somebody to stand out. Because everybody is just so damn good at it that
that's where steroids come.
You can't. Well, yeah, that steroids actually move that wall a bit. So you're right. Yeah. You can stand out. So I would think it would be similar, Steve. That our technology and our theories are just so cutting edge and refined over the decades that it's just so hard for somebody to really extend themselves that much farther. And but I think it's not a perfect analogy, of course, because I mean all you really need is a new theory, a new way to look at things, and you could really transcend all the other theories. But that's my thoughts immediately when you said that.
So a few things that are brought up in this discussion as to why aren't there Darwins and Newtons today. One is the notion of just the fact that we've picked the low-hanging fruit. You know, you can only discover relativity once. You can only discover that DNA is the molecule of inheritance once, or the notion of natural selection as a major mechanism of evolution. So once you establish these, you know, basic areas of science, and all the big revolution occurs, that further foundational discoveries or truly revolutionary discoveries become more and more rare.
I would just like to pause so I can briefly quote Steve for the record. Low-hanging fruit. Steve referring to Einstein's theory of relativity.
Yes. Well, that's the name of this theory, that the notion that the sort of the big questions that were hanging there, we've already sort of plucked those. Now, scientists are chasing more and more finer revisions of those theories, but they're not going to make discoveries that big again, you know, just because they're not there to be had. Some scientists say that, you know, just there are no crises in different fields that were similar to the crises in physics that were resolved by relativity and quantum mechanics, for example. Although they say that physics really is the one area where there is still a major crisis, you know, trying to
Oh yeah, many of them.
Resolve the, for example,
dark matter.
Well, yeah, so there's still major mysteries out there, like what is dark matter, but also just trying to resolve, you know, gravity and the other forces and
quantum
mechanics and relativity. You know, the theory of everything, string theory versus quantum loop gravity. So those are sort of big fish still hanging out there. But most other disciplines are chasing finer and finer revisions of basic concepts that have already been well established. Another factor is the fact that science is, and this probably relates most closely to what you were saying, Bob, about Gould's point, although I don't think I agree, it's not an exact analogy.
Right.
But the notion that the lone scientist, self-funded, you know, working in their garage or their basement, making major scientific discoveries, it's just, the world just doesn't exist that, work that way anymore. That science is
interdisciplinary.
Yeah, it's interdisciplinary. It's often high tech. It's collaborative. You know, it's communities of scientists working together, each adding a little piece to a bigger puzzle. I mean, think about it. Like Darwin working for decades by himself.
It won't happen.
Literally couldn't happen. Yeah. You cannot work for decades and not have and not get scooped,
right,
by 20 other people, you know, working on the same problem.
And Darwin almost did. Darwin almost did, you know, Wallace. So hello, yeah. You know.
Yeah, he was hesitant until
he really took his time. I mean, so the situation is not the same as it was back then.
Well, you know, those are all reasons why we might not get other great scientists, the likes of Einstein and Darwin. But there's really no evidence that's going to happen. I mean, it hasn't been that long since Einstein. And I don't think that we can take a span of 50, 60 years and say, well, we haven't seen another Einstein.
Well, we're pushing 100 years if you're talking about relativity, though, Rebecca.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's still
special. Was 1905.
Yeah, it's not enough time.
Yep.
Yeah, was it 1914 for general or 1915?
Yeah. Yeah, 15.
1915, I think, yeah. 2 years will be 100 years from general relativity.
We should celebrate something.
Oh, yeah.
Cake.
Relativistic cake. Yay.
So, but yeah, you're right. I totally agree with you. We need a longer period of time to see if this trend continues. I mean, I do think that the fact that the way science works, this notion of you start with very broad brushstrokes, and when we first started investigating the universe with scientific methodology, all of the classical knowledge about how things work were all systematically overturned. So there was all these revolutionary new scientific ideas establishing basic disciplines and basic notions about stuff. Again, that once you're largely or through that phase of science, now we're into the institutionalized, almost industrialized science where you have communities of people working, often in institutions like universities or in collaborations, making incremental advances themselves, but, you know, combining together to produce these greater and greater detailed refinements on existing knowledge. This also relates, Bob, to a discussion that you and I have had a number of times, and that is the nature of scientific progress, whether or not it follows the singularity type of model or paradigm where scientific advance accelerates geometrically.
Or exponentially.
Or even exponentially. Or whether you get to the point with certain disciplines of diminishing returns where it takes more and more work to make smaller and smaller advances. That's the low-hanging fruit hypothesis So, and I think that, you know, both are kind of true at the same time. I don't think those are exclusive ways of looking at things.
And not even just smaller advances, but I think you could say that if somebody works their entire life to, for instance, figure out dark matter, that's different than what we currently think of as the great scientists of the past who tackled many different subjects and, you know, produced many different kinds of results, as opposed to like, I do feel like, you know, we're going to have plenty of scientists that we look back on and we say, oh, that guy was brilliant because he led the team that figured out dark matter. It's just not going to be quite the same as, oh, he's the guy that figured out 18 different things we didn't know about mathematics before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the other thing. You look back at some of the scientific figures in centuries past, like astronomers and whatnot, who contributed in many, many different areas. not just in one narrow area. So that's the other thing. Scientific experts are getting more and more narrow in their focus, because you have to be. You have to be incredibly narrow in order to stay at the cutting edge of whatever it is you are researching. You can't be a master of multiple different disciplines. It's just not possible. All right. Well, a very interesting discussion. But let's move on. As I said, Rebecca, you're going to talk to us about a bit of neuroscience in the news, actually, having to do with brain damage and fear.
Yes, I am. As the neuroscience expert here on the podcast, I figured that I would tackle this. Okay, no. But I love this because this falls into my file of jobs that I wish I could do. And the job is this. You take some patients. They have a particular type of brain damage. It's, it involves lesions on their amygdala. And the amygdala is responsible for many things, obviously, but, one thing in particular, it seems to be responsible for, feelings of fear and anxiety. So, you're a scientist, you get these people, just a couple of them, because this is a pretty rare condition. Their, amygdalae are tiny and shriveled. And, they no longer can sense fear. They don't get afraid. So your job is to scare the crap out of them any way you can.
I could do it.
Well, for a very long time, they failed. There was one patient in particular, known only as SM, who apparently a researcher found just wandering down the street in traffic because she was not afraid of getting hit by a car. And the researchers took them and, they took patients like SM and they took them to haunted houses.
Cool.
They showed them spiders and snakes. They showed them horror films. They did everything they
could
think of.
Put a gun to their head. Yeah.
Putting them in situations where they might feel as though their life was in danger. And yeah, nothing. So first of all, super fun job. Things got really interesting recently, though. Researchers knew about this one particular technique that you can use to induce panic attacks in people with anxiety disorders. And you can do that by having them breathe in carbon dioxide, a higher rate of carbon dioxide than normal. And in people without anxiety, apparently, this doesn't really do much. It makes you breathe a bit more. People with anxiety disorders, it almost immediately triggers a panic attack. So they decided that they would do this to the people with the damaged amygdalae. And their hypothesis was, this is a fear response, and therefore our patients should not have any response to breathing in the carbon dioxide. So they had them breathe it in through a mask. And what they found, much to their shock, was that the brain damaged patients immediately became super panicky, even more so than a control group of participants who did not have this type of brain damage.
Scaredy cats?
Well, they asked the patients with brain damage how they felt, and they described feeling as though they were about to die. And some of them had never felt fear before in their lives. SM, in particular, had never felt afraid before. The others hadn't felt any kind of fear in decades. So you can imagine, no, you can't imagine. How could that feel to be afraid for the very first time? It must have been absolutely terrifying. Yeah. And that is how they described it right afterwards. They described it when they put themselves back in that moment, they described it as being unlike anything they had ever felt before and that they literally feared for their lives. Super interesting thing, though, is what happened later on. They did this test over the course of 2 days, and so they brought the patients back on the second day. And before they did the test again, they asked them, what do you feel going into this? You know, knowing what happened yesterday or whatever, the previous day, how do you feel? And all of them were completely nonchalant. they had completely lost any fear that they had felt in relation to the mask. And so they went through it again, apparently, and again. all of them completely freaked out and feared for their lives. So what does this all mean? Well, it could mean a lot of things. Some of the things they think it might mean. Our fear response is a bit more complicated than originally thought. Apparently, the amygdala isn't the only thing responsible for triggering fear responses in all cases. There's a difference, apparently, between different types of things we're afraid of. For instance, the carbon dioxide mask causes a lot of, like a different physiological reaction than just showing somebody a snake, having them handle a spider or something. And so our bodies, our brains react differently to those different stimuli. They also think that there could be something to the idea that the amygdala, might be responsible for stopping panic attacks from happening, since, which could help in studies on people with anxiety disorders. So there are a lot of different directions they can go in, but it's obviously going to require a bit more research. But yeah, I thought it was a really cool experiment, and, I want that job. I want my job to be scaring people who don't get scared.
Yeah, that's cool.
Steve, what do you think?
Let me give you my quick primer on the amygdala and the whole
story. Yeah, what do you know?
So it's actually really interesting. Very, very quickly, you know, the amygdala is part of the limbic system, or the limbic lobe, if you will, which is involved with emotion processing and also tied very closely to memory, which makes sense. The amygdala itself is involved with emotional processing, not just fear and anxiety. In fact, people who have these kinds of lesions of their amygdala are generally very flat in affect. It's not just, they're not just fearless. They also tend to be a little emotionless.
And they also have trouble detecting emotions in others.
Exactly. The ability to detect emotions in others is also apparently processed in the same location. The thalamus is the sensory relay part of the brain and very close to the amygdala. The thalamus gives sensory information to the amygdala, and that includes vision, hearing, smells, but also visceral information from your body. So if you feel discomfort in your body, that also can trigger a fear response. That information also goes to the cortex, and the cortex communicates to the amygdala, and the amygdala communicates back to the cortex as well. So imagine this. You see something out of the corner of your eye that could be threatening, and you have an immediate startle response. That's a fast circuit between your thalamus and your amygdala, right? So you get this immediate sensory information. It could be a threat, so you have this startle response. At the same time, the information is going to your cortex to evaluate the information. Then you go up there, and then you may realize more slowly, oh, this is nothing to be worried about. It's not a snake. It's a garden hose, for example. So that's why you may startle quickly over something that you then realize is not really a threat, that we could actually see why that's the case because of the circuitry in the brain and how long it takes to process things. The amygdala also is responsible for the memory of emotion, because it makes sense that you should remember that you're afraid of something so you don't have to learn it every time. And that's why, Rebecca, these people had no memory of their prior fear, because their amygdala is not working. They can't remember the fear response. So it's like they're starting afresh each time. What this adds, this extra bit adds, is there's got to be some other circuit that bypasses the amygdala that could then stimulate the fear processing in the cortex, as we experience fear in the cortex, not just in the amygdala. The amygdala is processing and triggering it and regulating it and remembering it, but we experience it, you know, partly in the cortex. And so there must be either some other circuit, you know, through this carbon dioxide response that could do that, or just some other way of stimulating the amygdala or those other circuits that is surviving in these patients. They essentially have calcifications that build up in their amygdala, so it hardens and doesn't work very much. But I don't know if it's 100% gone or not.
Do we know about what other effects high levels of carbon dioxide have on the brain? Is that established?
Well, there's lots of physiological effects. Primarily, it is the primary thing that drives your respiration. If you take a deep breath and hold your breath after whatever, a minute or two, depending on your conditioning, when you're desperate to breathe, that's because of high CO2. It's not because of low oxygen. You're actually exchanging oxygen just fine for a long time. It's because you're not moving, you're not blowing off carbon dioxide. It's a much more powerful respiratory drive. So that's the primary thing. It also dilates blood vessels and has a ton of other physiological effects, but.
That's actually really interesting because that explains, I guess, why when I was a kid and, you know, you're holding your breath underwater with your friends, I found that, you know, if you're trying to hold your breath a little longer, it makes it easier when you start blowing air out of your lungs. Like at the very end, it feels like a release. It feels much better.
But also exhale as much as you can and then hold your breath.
Yeah.
Doesn't last quite as long because then you don't have any air in your lungs to exchange oxygen. And so the oxygen drive kicks in much more quickly. But when you take a deep breath, it's the CO2 drive that's kicking in first. Anyway, yeah, very cool. We'll say, be interested to follow this and see what this ultimately leads to in terms of, again, fleshing out this circuitry in the brain. One more quick news item. We've spoken in the past about the whole feathered dinosaur thing. Again, it's one of my favorite areas of paleontology because, well, dinosaurs are cool, birds are cool, and birds are dinosaurs, right? And this is also, in my opinion, one of the biggest home runs for evolutionary theory. Birds as a group seem pretty isolated from any other group. I mean, yes, they're vertebrates. You know, they're related to other vertebrates, but they seem pretty distinct from other vertebrates. They fly, they have feathers, etc. And so the feathered dinosaurs significantly fills in the space, you know, the evolutionary space between non-avian dinosaurs and birds. And so it's exactly what you would predict from evolutionary theory, that they must be connected to some other group somehow. And lo and behold, we found all these fossils, which it's cool in that dinosaurs like Velociraptor, like, you know, from Jurassic Park, for example, they had feathers. Now we have to completely reimagine what that whole group of theropod dinosaurs looked like. Many of them had feathers.
Oh, I smell a remake.
Yeah.
No, you could just George Lucas it. Yeah. Go back and do a special edition.
Redo the CG.
CG overlay.
Paleontologists recently discovered another species of feathered dinosaur, again, in China. There's a huge deposit of, you know, again, I guess there were a lot of feathered dinosaurs, Paravis, at that time in location, and paleontologists are finding more and more of them. This one is called Eosinopteryx brevipenna, which is means red and stubby-winged. And he's one of the smallest, very tiny little guy, a beautiful transitional species, absolutely beautiful. Looks like a dinosaur, bony tail, clawed fingers, feet made for running, teeth, except it has feathers. It had feathers all over its body, but could not fly. Its wings were too stubby to fly.
Aww.
So, I mean, it's, you know, again, it's beautifully transitional between non-avian dinosaurs and birds. But, of course, that's not a problem for people like Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis, who writes...
Two more gaps.
Yeah. Yep. No, not even. Worse than that. He says, now, one headline described the fossil as, quote-unquote, almost bird-like, and the authors of the report in Nature Communications note many features the fossil share with living birds, particularly those that live on the ground. In fact, Dr. Elizabeth Mitchell and Dr. David Menton, both doctors from Answers in Genesis, mind you, both examined the photos of the fossil and the criteria the authors used in classifying the fossil as a dinosaur. They agreed that it is a bird, not a feathered dinosaur. Well, they agree.
I mean, the creationists looked at some photos.
There you go.
And yeah, and the article notes features it shares with living birds and other features it shares with dinosaurs. That's why it's transitional, because it has some bird-like features and some dinosaur-like features. I mean, bony tail, teeth. It lacks all of the evolutionary adaptations to full flapping flight, which all birds have. So the thing is not just a regular, ordinary bird. It is a feathered dinosaur. It's just ridiculous. But what it shows is there is essentially no limit to the denial of transitional fossils that the creationists can do. Complete and utter denial. And it's just mindless.
I picture those quote unquote doctors going to their desk every day and just like opening up the paper and just going, shit.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Seriously. That's like the one thing. It's like, you know, God, that's got to bother them. It's
got to
bother
them.
They've got to look at this and go, oh, God, what are we going to say about this one? Look at the thing. Oh, it's clearly a dinosaur with feathers.
They're
how
never
going to rationalize that away?
Yeah. How do I explain that God created death?
Down deep, somewhere deep in their psyche, they've got to be bothered by such stunning evidence that they're wrong. I just, it's hard to imagine. But, you know, we never underestimate, you know, people's ability to rationalize and compartmentalize, et cetera. Unbelievable. Well, Evan, you have to catch us up on Who's That Noisy.
I do, in fact, have to do that. And I will play for you right now the Who's That Noisy from last week. Here we go.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Very nice. A very recognizable line. Most people, I think, recognize that as...
They sure did.
Carl Sagan.
Carl Sagan, yep, from the Cosmos series. Episode 9, The Lives of Stars. It is the opening line. It is a wonderful, wonderful series. And it is a series that my daughter Rachel really, really admires and has taken quite a liking to. You know, she watches it, I would say, almost every day.
Whoa.
And well, you know, it's kind of...
What a geek.
It's she's got a DVR in a room and a TV, and she, you know, she every night before she goes to sleep, you know, she wants to watch a little bit of what Carl Sagan has to say. So it, you know, puts her in the right frame of mind for a nice night of sleep and dreams. And she's actually picked up quite a few things from that.
I've exposed my daughters to it as well, and they've watched a lot of it. I think they're interested in it, but they're not in love with it, and they complain about the fact that it looks so dated.
Yes.
They're so spoiled. They're like, oh, the special, that's ancient to them, you know?
Yeah.
They're having a hard time getting past that, which is disappointing. But I guess we'll just have to wait for Neil deGrasse Tyson's remake of the series.
In the meanwhile, you could pick up Brian Cox's series, Wonders of the Universe and Wonders of the Solar System, which are really well produced.
Yeah, until the new Cosmos series gets launched. Starring Neil deGrasse Tyson with Seth MacFarlane as executive producer. That is going to be quite a
epic
series in its own right. I'm sure it will be fantastic. And yes, a lot of people caught the fact that that was, in fact, a Carl Sagan quote. Nobody picked up that it was my daughter Rachel actually saying the words, but that's okay. I went ahead and put everyone in who, you know, said it was the Carl Sagan quote. I put them into the drawing for this week.
Oh, aren't you generous, Evan?
Yeah, well, you know, like to share the love with as many people as possible. This week's winner is Adam Bellows. So, Adam, congratulations. You are in the final drawing at the end of the year, in which you might be joining us on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe to participate in an episode of Science or Fiction. So congratulations, Adam, and thank you for everyone for answering.
And now I anxiously await this week's Who's That Noisy?
As do I. I would like for the audience to identify the person who is talking. Here we go.
I love oxygen because it plays such an important role in keeping alive the terrestrial animals on this planet.
Yeah, I'm quite partial to oxygen myself.
Yeah, I've gotten used to it over the last 43 years or so. Well, actually, 44. Yeah.
It does a body good.
So it's a bit, I don't know, a bit nondescript, but, you know, maybe some people will pick up on maybe a little hint here or there and figure it out. Go ahead and send us your answer. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email we've set up for Who's That Noisy Answers, or you can go ahead and post your answer on sguforums.com. That is our forums. I wish everyone the best of luck this week.
Now, Evan, we had a bit of a lively discussion about the puzzle answer that we discussed last week, the Boy Born on Tuesday puzzle.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my goodness. A lively discussion. Yes, indeed. I'll just say a few things, though. I read a lot of responses, especially those on the forums and people who sent in emails, and certainly they were also, you know, posting them on Facebook. And there's room for interpretation, shall we say. I get some of the points that some people are making, that there is some ambiguity there, that you can read a few different things into and therefore perhaps come up with different answers. Some people who started with being so sure, though, that, you know, that they were sure this was like 50%, no difference, half, exactly half. And they sort of went through a process of working it out themselves and conferring with other people, reading what other people have to say and doing their own, you know, back of the envelope calculations. In fact, there's some beautiful graphics and things that people posted on the forums, actually, you know, in an attempt to help explain this. And they've, some people sort of, you know, got the point that, you know, 13 over 27, 13 out of 27 or 48.1% might be the most correct answer of the possible answers to this particular puzzle. Would you guys say that that's kind of a fair interpretation of how that evolved?
Well, some listeners thought that the question was ambiguous because saying I have one boy born on a Tuesday means that both boys could not have been born on a Tuesday, but that's actually irrelevant. That's not the case. The reason you come up with 13 out of 27 instead of 14 out of 28 is because you can't count both boys being born on a Tuesday twice, which is what you would have to do in order to get to the 14 out of 28 calculation. So the answer is 13 out of 27, no matter how you interpret it. But that still also doesn't alter the fact that saying, if you say I have two children, one is a boy, what's the chance I have two boys? The answer is 1/3.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to saying, I have two children, the first one is a boy, what's the chance that I have two boys? Then it's 50%, which is interesting, and that sort of gets to, you know, set theory and how you come by the information and how that alters the later odds.
What I'll do this week is, because I solicited the advice of a few professional mathematicians.
Yeah, what do they know?
Eh, what do they know? And on the message boards this weekend, once the show notes go up and the forum thread begins, I'll go ahead and post a couple of those responses we got just to share with other people and how they arrived. These mathematicians basically said that the 13 over 27 answer is the correct one. And I'll let the debate sort of continue online and let the exchange of ideas continue to flow. It's very healthy, I think. This is a very healthy exercise in that regard.
Yeah. So you're saying don't complain to us. Read what the mathematicians have to say.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm kind of just the messenger here. I'm not a mathematician by any stretch. You know, I kind of had to rely on other people. And certainly also Martin Gardner, you know, presented this way back, you know, several years ago. And he was, you know, he's one of the most famous puzzle spinners out there and mathematicians. So, you know, I was thinking, hey, if it's good enough for Martin, it's probably going to be good enough for me and most people. So, but we'll let people continue to talk about it.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Evan.
Yep.
Well, joining me for a few minutes now is George Hrob. George, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, it's so nice to be back. Hi.
How long has it been? Weeks?
Oh, it's been long. It's been long. Yeah, weeks. Yeah, minutes. Days. It only seems like minutes. So he's back again? Oh, great.
Always love chatting with you, but we're bringing you on tonight just for a few minutes so that you could tell us about the exciting new developments with Nexus.
Well, we've been plotting and we've been conniving and we've been determining what we can do to make the Friday night of Nexus not only spatial but extra spatial. And in years past, it's been kind of a separate event. So last year we had the Story Collider. In years past, it was sort of different stuff. And this year we thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could get some kind of a performance, but not just a performance, something that involves and includes the themes of Nexus. And what we've come up with is a program that's called Stimulus Response.
Mm-hmm.
And this is we're calling it a Nexus of Science and Improvisation. A question I often, probably the most asked question, apart from like clothing advice that I get, is where do ideas come from? How do you write a song? Where do you get the inspiration? How does it work when you're writing music, when you're creating art? What happens? And pretty much my answer almost always is I have no idea.
Right.
What this evening is going to sort of talk about and address is maybe slightly try to answer that question as to what's going on neurologically in the mind of an improviser. So it's a kind of a cool idea. The event is going to be sort of a three-part, three-act thing. The first act is going to be me and my cousin, Roman Hrob, is a professor of art at Bard College. He and I are going to take the stage for the first act, and I'm going to improvise and build this real-time massive piece of music sort of a 45-minute improvised symphony, sort of using loops and using all kinds of stuff to make this one-of-a-kind, unique, in-the-moment piece of music. And Roman is going to paint a huge mural in front of everyone, from a blank canvas to a finished piece of art, in that time. I'll see what he's doing. He, of course, will hear what I'm doing, and we'll be kind of inspired and sort of set up by each other, and whatever happens, happens. It's He and I have done this in the past. It's some of the most satisfying performances I've ever been involved in, have been doing these kind of art and music projects. So going from a complete blank canvas and a quiet room to a finished piece of art and a 45-minute constructed symphony is the goal. That's the first act. The second act, then, will be we're going to get not only Roman and me, but the people that will be in Act 3, which will be improvising comedians. We'll get them together, as well as some specialists that know how the brain works. I don't know where we could find anyone who would be a specialist in, you know, neural. Do you know anybody? Maybe you know.
Yeah, maybe I do know people who actually study the brain and who know the brain.
Oh, cool. So if you can, maybe we can talk later. We can figure.
Yeah, might be able to give you a hookup there.
Well, obviously, we'll have a great panel where we're going to sort of try to discuss what's going on, what's happening in the brain in the moments of improvisation. What do we think is happening? That's going to be like a 20-minute sort of panel, maybe some questions, some answers. And then the third part, the big finale, Act 3 of this, is going to be those improvising comedians who are going to sort of build a comedic scene or a sequence using a inspiration from a noted Nexus attendee, shall we say. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give anything away yet because we're not 100% done, but it'll be sort of like a day in the life of a famous Nexus attendee. And this will be done. It's members of the Upright Citizen Brigade as well as some other sort of well-known New York comedic improvisers. So everybody has seen Whose Line Is It Anyway? Mm-hmm. It'll sort of be like that, but, you know, whose brain is it anyway? Sort of that's the approach. So it's going to be a three-act thing. I think it's going to be really, really interesting and different from what you normally see at conferences like this. I know I can't think of anything else that's been done that's quite like this at Nexus, let alone at any other kind of skeptic or science or critical thinking conference. I'm really, really excited.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. I'm looking forward to it myself. And there's going to be some audience, a lot of audience participation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sort of some of the suggestions for the improvising will be taken from the audience, as well as we might incorporate, you know, a Twitter stream into the music that I'm creating so that I can, you know, maybe I'll get lyrics tweeted to me in the middle of doing something. I'll have to come up with a melody to sing to someone. We're not exactly sure, but there's going to be all kinds of, yeah, involvement. And the most extra special thing about this is the fact that it's going to be a unique, one-of-a-kind experience. I mean, this will never be repeated again. What happens on that night will never be repeated again. And it's going to be monstrously unique and difficult, and there's a chance that it might not work, which is sort of the fun of an experience like this, mm-hmm. and sort of fun of doing a performance like that, kind of on, you know, the no net living on an edge. I have to mention Brian Wecht, of course. Brian Wecht, who did the Story Collider last year, who organized that, he's a major. He and I kind of came up with this structure, so I want to sort of thank him for what he did. I'm like I said, I'm really selling this, but I'm really excited about it because it's some of the most satisfying music I've ever created has been in the moment, improvising under pressure. And I think it's going to be a fun, different kind of experience.
Sounds awesome. And this is Friday night of Nexus. And people
April
can sign
5th,
up
yes.
April 5th. So people can sign up for this as they would register for Nexus itself or for any of the workshops or for any part of Nexus.
Exactly.
And you and I are running a workshop together during the day on Friday.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. The sort of how to send your message across in podcasting.
Podcasting and other social media.
Yes, yes.
So I guess between now and then, you and I have to learn something about podcasting.
I'll probably start a podcast if you want to start a podcast, and we'll just see how it goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. All right, George. Talk
nice.
To you later.
All right, man.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yep.
Ready.
Okay. Here we go. Item number one. A new systematic review concludes that CT scans in young patients may pose a greater increased risk of cancer than the diagnostic benefits they provide. Item number two. New research shows that people have greater happiness and sense of well-being as they age, regardless of when they were born. And item number three, a new recent review of research involving 122 personality characteristics finds no significant difference in male and female profiles. Evan, go first.
The first one about the systematic review concludes that CT scans in young patients may pose a greater increased risk of cancer than the diagnostic benefits they provide. Wouldn't that be awful? A greater increased risk of cancer. I'm going to wrap my mind around that a bit and probably come back to it, Steve. I'll go on to the next one. Number two, new research shows that people have greater happiness and sense of well-being as they age, regardless of when they were born. I could see that as being true, certainly. You know, your set of life experiences, perhaps, you know, plays an overall role in that. But regardless of when they were born, that's the key part of this, which may indicate that they've tested this before, done studies on this prior, and there have been perhaps differences indicating when certain people were born that those certain people do have a greater sense than others. The last one, a recent review of research involving 122 personality characteristics finds no significant difference in male and female profiles. No significant difference. That's to me, that's kind of the most fascinating one of the three of these. I'm thinking that one is going to wind up being true. Happiness one. Greater happiness and sense of well-being, regardless of when they're born. No, I think there'll be differences. There'll wind up being differences there. If this is, in fact, the way the evidence has panned out. I'll say the happiness and sense of well-being one, Steve, is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
The CT scans, why would age that much of a factor? I mean, it's kind of think that if, from what I've read in the past, that that the younger you are, I mean, the better you are able to heal and come back from any type of damage. So why would? But then there's other unique aspects of being young that could contribute. Ah, man, that one's tough. Happiness and sense of well-being. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not even sure I agree with the idea that kind of like the premise that older you are, that your sense of happiness and well-being improves as you get older. I'm not even sure I agree with that. The 122 personality characteristics, that one makes the most sense to me. It kind of reminds me of the differences between the various human races, where the differences within a race are greater than the differences between the races. So that kind of strikes me as maybe similar to gender. So I'm not buying the fact that there's actually I am. I am buying that there's no significant difference between the profiles. So that one makes the most sense to me. Between one and two. Yeah, I guess I'll go with the happiness one. I've got the most problem with that one, so I'll say that one's fiction.
And Rebecca.
I was leaning in another direction, so this is interesting. Finding no significant differences between men and women in terms of personality characteristics, yeah, that makes sense. I have seen other studies, small studies, that have claimed to show some kind of difference, but I think when you break it down to just pure personality characteristics and you look at how everything falls, I think Bob's exactly right when he compares this to differences outside of a group being less than differences within a group. I think it's exactly the same for men and women. There's just a huge amount of variation. So yeah, for me, it's between the other two. The greater happiness and sense of well-being as you age, regardless of when you're born, I don't know, that makes sense to me. Maybe because I often think of a study that I read about. They asked subjects to name the age at which they were their happiest, and people tended to pick an age 10 years beneath their current age, but that was true for people at every age. Huh. So people who were 20 said 10, 30 said 20, you know, and the average of the whole study ended up being something like 65 or something. I don't know. I can believe that. And I think that people do tend to get happier. And sense of well-being, that makes sense to me. You figure out who you are and where you are in life. CT scans in young patients posing greater increased risk of cancer than the benefits. Bob was wondering why young patients, and that got me thinking, why young patients? Well, differences between young and old patients that I can think of, older patients may have cancer already, have an increased chance of already being having some kind of cancer issues going on. So I feel like that would kind of fit with the reverse of this. Young patients aren't necessarily at the same risk as older patients. And also younger patients probably are going in for head injuries more. I feel like younger people would be getting more serious injuries that would require CT scans. So how far has technology come along? Are we still, is there still like a huge dose of radiation that they're getting every time they go in? I'm not so sure. So that one is really suspicious. So yeah, it's between that one and the happiness thing. I'm going to go against the team. I'm going to go with the CT scans one. I find it fishy.
Okay.
That's fiction.
Interesting. So you all agree on the third one, so we'll start there, that a recent review of research involving 122 personality characteristics finds no significant difference in male and female profiles. You all buy this one, and this one is science. Very interesting.
Okay.
I'll say at this point that all of these items were similar in that they involved a new way of looking at statistics, of looking at data. So you'll see how that applies.
Fitting in with the theme of the puzzle.
Yeah. So, in this one, Bob, you hit the nail on the head that there are lots of studies which say, oh, look, if you look at 1,000 men and you look at 1,000 women on this personality profile, there's a difference. Well, there's an average difference. There's a difference between the average of all the women and the average of all the men. But if you look at the data the other way, if you take an individual and look at their profile of how they rate on all these different personality characteristics, can you predict from that 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 individual is a male or female? Mm. And the answer is no, you can't. Because, as you say, there's more overlap. There's far greater intra-group difference than intergroup difference. And there really isn't any, significant pattern that will tell you this person must be a female and this person must be a male. Partly this is because a lot of traits that stereotypically are thought of as being male or female are really not. Like math ability is a classic one. It really isn't that difference between men and women. It's also the notion that we tend to follow stereotypes and insufficiently appreciate the variability within groups. So like how much individual women and individual men will vary on all of these traits. Now there are a couple of caveats here. One is that a lot of this data is survey data. So it's essentially asking people about these characteristics. And the researchers warn that if you looked at behaviors, then you may get some different results. For example, like asking men and women how empathic they are does not result in a huge difference. But maybe if you tracked something like how many times in the last year did the individual send somebody a birthday card, then you might find greater differences. Because self-reporting may involve some normalizing bias, you know, because people will give answers that they think are the correct ones. So that's it. That's one caveat to this study, to this data. They also said that, you know, this is also holds only for the U.S. where the study was done, and that cultures, like Middle Eastern cultures, for example, that have much more prescribed gender roles, that there would be greater differences, but that's probably, you know, the implication being that it would be cultural. And that in cultures where the gender roles are more, flexible, that, and you don't see that much of a difference between.
Where was this study done?
This is the lead author is Bobby Carruthers, Center for Public Health System Science at Washington University in St. Louis.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing it done in a different culture.
Yeah. So interesting study. I like the fact that you sort of get different answers depending on how you look at the data.
Yeah.
And it's always good to keep that in mind. And in general, this is just a general principle of epidemiology. Of this kind of observational studies, when you're looking at average differences between groups versus how predictive a trait is for an individual. That's important in medicine, for example. I often make this point to residents and students. Don't get so caught up in what the textbook stereotypical presentation is. You have to know what the full range of a disease is, or the full range of normal, you know, in people. And we sort of fall for the representativeness heuristic. I think we've talked about this on the show before. Where, we sort of are overly, impressed by how typical something is or representative it is of a group, a category, a disease, and pay less attention to the statistical predictability, the base rate and how predictive things are. So I said, don't tell me what, like when I will tell medical students, don't worry about whether or not this symptom is typical of this disease. I want to know how predictive it is that this is the diagnosis. And that's, I think, exactly analogous here. I don't want to know whether or not math ability is typical of a man or a woman. You look at the data as, does having math aptitude predict that that person is likely to be a man or a woman? And this study is saying basically no. They also looked at physical characteristics using the same analysis, and physical characteristics do predict whether or not somebody is likely to be male or female, because there are like non-overlapping, really significant differences when you look at overall body size, shoulder, you know, width, muscle mass, testosterone levels. When you look at things like that, they do separate out much more, and sometimes fairly significantly with not much overlap. All right, well, let's move on. I guess we'll go back to number one. A new systematic review concludes that CT scans in young patients may pose a greater increased risk of cancer than the diagnostic benefits they provide. Rebecca, you think this is the fiction. The guys think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
I'm glad, actually.
Good work, Rebecca.
Yeah, I know it. Kind of happy that it. One's the fiction.
Not in time.
You did not know it, or you would have said it.
So the reason
it actually it came to me after I made my decision. Well, tell me, Steve, if I'm even
too.
Tell me if I'm even close. My thinking was that, well, the younger you are, the more life you have ahead of you for those probabilities to come to fruition.
Well, that's part of it. So there's a special concern for radiation exposure in young people because they are more sensitive to radiation, and because they will have more life ahead of them for that radiation exposure risk to come to fruition. Hmm. You know, sometimes getting exposed to radiation could lead to cancer down the road. Right. Of course, if you're 80, there's not much down the road. But if you're 20 or 15, that's a lot more years for that risk to come back and bite you. But also just younger people are more susceptible intrinsically to the effects of radiation in terms of increasing the risk of cancer. Now, what the researchers were interested in is, you know, prior studies show, that people who get especially multiple CT scans, and especially when they're young, do have an increased risk, lifetime risk of cancers, something on the order of magnitude of 0.1%, which, you know, sounds small, but it's not insignificant. You know, that's 1 in 1,000 people. That's a real number that we are concerned about in medicine, especially when you're talking about something like developing cancer. What these researchers did, though, is they said, well, okay, that's interesting, but we also have to look at the other side of the coin. We have to look at the benefit of doing the CAT scan. So it's really only meaningful, that 0.1%, if we look at the risk versus the benefit. And what they found was that children and young adults who were getting CAT scans, for whatever reason, that they had a 5-year mortality that was in the 3 to 5% range, where normally the 5-year mortality would be just taking the population as a whole would be more like 1%. So, significant increase risk of dying because, as Rebecca, you nailed this one in that. If you're a young person getting a CAT scan, you have something serious wrong with you. You were in a car accident, you have a major trauma, you have a significant disease like cancer already. And you know, we have to consider the benefits to the individual in the management of their very serious illness when considering this small, you know, but significant increase in the long-term risk of developing a complication of the CAT scan. They also made the point, and again, did you read the article, Rebecca?
No.
Okay. But you brought up another point that they make, which is that,
it's a fire.
Yeah, this study was looking at, since they were looking, you know, they had to look at people who had CAT scans 10 or more years ago, because this is a long-term sort of follow-up. And they said, since these issues have been brought to attention in the last decade or so, that, CAT scans have been deliberately reconfigured to expose patients to less radiation. So, this is looking at a cohort that got the older CAT scans with a higher exposure to radiation, but today the risk is even less because radiation exposure has been decreased with the more recent CAT scans. And, you know, they're also saying, we're not saying be complacent. They're saying, you know, absolutely don't do a CAT scan unless it's absolutely necessary, especially in a young person. Try to minimize CAT scans and, again, using the newer techniques to minimize radiation. But if you need to do it, do it. You know, the benefits are going to outweigh the risks.
I had a concussion when I was little. I didn't get a CAT scan.
Is that right?
Yeah. I was disappointed. I wanted to go on the big machine.
Explains a lot, actually. The last one is
nice.
New research shows that people have greater happiness and sense of well-being as they age, regardless of when they were born. Bob and Evan think this one is the fiction, but this one is, of course, science.
I'm actually kind of happy about this, too.
Yeah, now, this is yet another way of saying, okay, wait a minute, let's look at this data a little differently. Now, prior studies, if you looked at people of different ages, and they found that older people were less happy and had a lower sense of well-being. And, right, so if you look at young people, young adults, older adults, and older people, it looked as if the older you got, the less happy you were. But what this study did was it looked at long-term data where there was data available for people throughout their lives. And they looked at, individual groups of people. And it turns out if you follow a person or a group of people over the course of their lives, they get happier and have a greater sense of well-being as they age. The problem was, with the previous way of looking at the data, was that older generations were less happy than younger generations. And that's just because life was harder back then. You know, if you lived through the Depression, you generally have lower happiness and lower sense of well-being than people who lived in later generations in the middle of the 20th century, and people who grew up at the end of the 20th century were happier still. But within each generation, people tend to get happier and have a greater sense of well-being as they age. But subsequent generations have been getting happier and having a greater sense of well-being just because life has become overall easier. Now, this suggests another interesting notion, and that is that, well, perhaps the conditions of your childhood affect your happiness for the rest of your life, because that seems to be the case. They also wonder about the next generation. Is this trend of increased happiness going to hold true, or will the prolonged recession and bad job market, etc., will that have negative impacts on the current generation? Obviously, we don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
I don't want people to be sad all their lives.
Right.
Well, so sad. Yeah.
Good job, Rebecca. Yeah, that was interesting.
Good job.
I think all the items were interesting this week.
My happiness is
interesting. Very interesting. I certainly didn't read any of them, so.
Well, good. Evan, you are going to cover Jay for the quote this week.
It'll be an honor to substitute for Jay this week. Here we go. Nothing exists except atoms and empty space. Everything else is opinion. Democritus.
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 Hardcore, that guy.
What about virtual particles? I don't think I agree.
That's a classical view of reality, right, Bob?
Mm-hmm. You know, but not bad for, 400 BC. I mean,
not bad.
You're kind of ahead. Yeah. I think ahead of your time. You
low hanging fruit. 2400
years.
Atoms in empty space, and it's mostly empty space.
I could have come up with that saying if I was born several
2400 years ago,
a couple thousand years ago, probably. Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you,
welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
Happy birthday to little Dylan.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.